Welcome to Getting Work to Work, a weekly podcast exploring the world of work and how creative entrepreneurs, storytellers, and rule breakers infuse their daily lives with creativity and curiosity. I first met today's guest near the beginning of my creative journey at the Northwest Film Center in Portland, Oregon, where I was taking a workshop on interviewing techniques. Almost 20 years later, he's on Getting Work to Work to share his latest project hitting theaters and the internet today. Brian Lindstrom is a documentarian and co-director of Lost Angel, The Genius of Judy Sill. In our conversation, Brian shares what captures his attention in filmmaking, the stories of struggles and victories, and the beauty, strength, and resilience to overcome the odds. He talks about his first exposure to Judy's music in the early days of YouTube, why she was more than the one-note tragic story her Wikipedia page describes, why some projects need to take longer than others, and the joys of collaboration he experienced on this film. Most importantly, Brian reminds us of the importance of independent filmmakers and how we can vote with our attention and our wallets. Show notes for this episode can be found at gwtw.co/772. While you're there, you'll also find the entire podcast archive, links to the short documentary series and weekly newsletter, and the latest merch to show your love and support of the show.
I really love the craft of documentary filmmaking, so I'm whenever I have a documentarian on, it's always a pleasure because it's probably the thing that I wish I could do all the time, but you know, it's not always something that you can do all the time.
I hear that.
Well, Brian, welcome to Getting Work to Work. It is an absolute pleasure to talk with you. We've crossed paths many, many years before when you taught courses at the Northwest Film Center in Portland, Oregon, and I had the pleasure of taking one of those courses. Sadly, it was probably in the era where I thought I knew everything. And so, you know, I probably didn't get what I would get out of it now, because as you get older and more humbled by life, you tend to be like, oh, right, I
don't know everything.
So welcome. I'm glad you're here.
Oh, thank you so much, Chris. It's great to be here. And there's nothing like documentary filmmaking to remind us that we certainly don't know everything.
Yes. Well, I mean, I remember talking to a friend years ago, and he's like, Chris, I don't understand why you like documentaries so much. He's like, why don't you invest your time in like making narratives and using your imagination? It's just like, because people are just too damn interesting. Alive or dead.
You've got the bug.
Yeah. I mean, okay, this is a little tangent, but like I was watching a documentary on Robert Englund, the actor behind Freddy Krueger. And it was just an amazing documentary where you feel like you know him and you know, sure, you can watch Nightmare on Elm Street, but you get nothing about the actor himself and how much he cares for any role he's in. Mm-hmm. That's the power of documentary.
What's that old saying? Like, you know, always be nice to people because you have no idea what, you know, battle they're waging. Yeah. Or waging. And I think documentary does that, right? I mean, it, especially a certain kind that can be so immersive that you really get into the person's head and heart and start to understand, you know, who they are and what struggles they face and the strength with which they face them.
Well, as someone who has had a career in documentary, would you say that you're endlessly curious about documentary, or are you endlessly curious about something else?
To tell you the truth, well, I'm in, just like you said, I'm endlessly curious about people, and especially, you know, this wonderful gift of resilience and where it comes from and how it's utilized and how it can be developed. And documentary is simply a means to get there. To tell you the truth, I'm not someone who just like, you know, rhapsodizes over different forms of documentary. I mean, I'm interested in it, but it's always a path to that kind of revelatory thing about what makes this person tick.
It's interesting you had mentioned resilience because, you know, making film, making art requires resilience and stubbornness and a desire to never quit, even when you quit 17 times in a project. How have you learned resilience along the way?
Well, you know, usually it has something to do with my relationship to the subject matter and also the subject, the people in the film. And it almost always comes down to a sort of feeling that, like, you know, God damn it, if they can survive whatever it is, I can certainly make a damn film.
Right.
And who wants to hear about how hard it is to make a film? I mean, it's, you know, not that interesting, but, you know, when you have people that have, like, you know, come back from, you know, devastating addictions or, you know, any number of, you know, challenges, that's where the real motivation is just to share that with a wider audience.
When you're meeting people or learning people's stories, how do you know when something is meant to be magnified to the level of a film?
Usually it's a feeling I have that this person has an incredible strength that they may not even be aware of. And it's sort of the antithesis of the thing of, like, someone coming up to you and saying, hey, make a documentary about me, run for the hills, right? But it's really just this kind of feeling of, wow, I want to share this person's struggles and victories with a wider audience. And maybe in doing so, reveal to them some of their beauty and strength that they may not even be aware of.
I love that. I think sometimes when we think of filmmakers, we think of, like, these gearheads who just love spending all of their free money on, you know, technology, cameras and stuff. But I love this picture of sitting with someone and hearing their struggles and being present in their life. Mm. I think there's a beauty, not to over-glamorize it, but I mean, it's hard to sit sometimes in people's struggles.
It is. It is. And I think there's, you know, a fine line to be tread there about, you want to acknowledge the suffering, but you also want to acknowledge the strength and the healing. I heard a great quote the other day, like, don't be too loyal to your pain.
I love that.
Which I think is a good thing. But I mean, it's interesting because it brings up, you know, the Judy Sill film that myself and my co-director Andy Brown and editor Mike Ward and producer Peter Kenny just finished, and a whole bunch of other people that worked on it. That's an issue that we were aware of, is that you know, you need to share the struggle enough to make the triumph have context.
That gave me chills, just kind of taking that in, just that juxtaposition between struggle and triumph. And on one hand, it has to be challenging when the subject is long gone. You know, like, what does the triumph look like when they're dead?
Right. And I think in Judy's case, it is the rediscovery of her music by a whole new generation and generations of devoted fans. And obviously, we're hoping the film will expand the number of fans.
How did you learn of Judy Sill?
Andy, my co-director, read an interview with the musician Andy Partridge of XTC, like back in 2000. And Partridge is a huge Judy Sill devotee and claims her as a huge inspiration. And so that got Andy Brown into Judy. And then when YouTube came on the scene, I think in 2008, I was visiting Andy in New York, and he was really excited to show me the YouTube clip of Judy singing The Kiss on the Old Grey Whistle Test, because he knew it would blow me away. And indeed it did. And we just started a deep dive into Judy's music and then into her life as well. And the first thing that really drew us, besides just the majesty of her music, was at first glance the seeming contradiction of the kind of salacious facts of her life, like, versus the kind of ethereal spiritual power of her music. And so we started to really delve into that. And our first task was just to make sure that no one else had already made a documentary or were making a documentary about Judy. So we kind of did our due diligence and found that indeed we were the first. And we were very lucky in that there was a posthumous album of Judy's released by Pat Thomas and Patrick Roques in 2006, I believe. It's called Dreams Come True. And Patrick and Pat made a great booklet, which is kind of like an oral history of Judy's life through the people who knew her. And so that was like a template of our first round of interviews, which we shot in December of 2013. And it was just a huge help. And what was so gratifying, Chris, is that all the people that really knew Judy, her dear friends, her intimates, first of all, this, you know, and this was like 40 years after her death, or 30 years after her death, she was still like a palpable presence in their lives, you know? And so much of the time, I think as documentarians, we just have to kind of realize that, like, just kind of basic things like, okay, if Judy impacted those people, maybe she'd impact an audience the same way, you know, to kind of trust what you're seeing, you know? And so they also said that Judy was just like a really fun person to be around. She was kind of a light, that she was a dear friend. She knew everyone's birthdays. She always made sure everyone got together for holidays. You know, she was just a really kind of loving person, which was wonderful to hear, because the Wikipedia version of Judy Sill is kind of a doom and gloom, tragic artist. And that's a very kind of one note story. And although, you know, Judy does have her dark side for sure, and the, you know, some challenging things in her life, she wasn't just a one note person. She was a full 360 degree personality, like we all are, full of light and dark and everything in between. And we were really gratified that we would be able to, you know, share that with an audience.
Oh, I love that. I love that, that statement of she's more than just how Wikipedia describes her.
Yeah.
And I just think there's, what an amazing excavation, in a sense, of her life to be able to talk to people who were impacted by her personally and professionally.
It was really poignant. And it was also just very moving and powerful because, you know, these people at that point were in their 70s. You know, one obvious thing that an early death deprives you of is the gift of aging, right? And the gift of looking back on your life and, you know, appreciating things and people. And, you know, these people all had that wisdom, and they were able to kind of, you know, share their recollections with Judy. And also, you know, how Judy still impacts them, not just her music, but her person, her personality.
How do you take that in as not just a filmmaker, but a human being, a spouse, I'm assuming a father, you know, how do you let this tangential experience with Judy kind of shape your life?
That's a great question. I mean, one thing Judy's story really hits home for me is just how far we've come as a culture in terms of things like addiction and childhood trauma, sexual abuse, all those things, which, you know, weren't even like in the vernacular back then. And now, you know, I've often thought, like, what would it have been like if Judy had been born at a different time? You know, like if she was kind of going through those things right now, I think there's so much more societal support and awareness for that, you know, but she had to kind of grapple with all those things in a kind of climate and culture where you really didn't talk about that stuff. And the idea that people could recover from addiction wasn't even like, or that addiction was a disease wasn't really understood. One thing I think the film makes plain is that, you know, Judy was a strong, talented, loving, beloved person who had a lot of challenges in life, including addiction, and the disease of addiction. You know, ultimately, you know, I hate to use these metaphors or whatever, but it kind of won out, you know, but that doesn't mean that all that she accomplished and all that she felt and shared, you know, doesn't have incredible meaning and power.
So first interviews in 2013, yeah. First awareness in 2008. I mean, I'm not great at math, but 16 years is a long time of sitting with a project.
Well, just to be clear, we started shooting in 2013. So that's kind of when the project started proper.
11 years, 11. Give or take five.
As my co-director Andy says, just 11 years.
Just 11 years.
Every project I've had that's like taken a long time, like Alien Boy, took, I think, 5 years. But looking back, it's like there's a, you know, each project has its own lifeblood and its own kind of, it's like a child in a way. And it just, it lets you know when it's at a certain stage. And you look back and it's kind of like, thank God they took that long, because there's always certain elements of the film that would never have been possible had it happened earlier. And in Alien Boy, like all of the depositions of the officers involved in that tragic killing of James Chassie would never have been available if we would have released the film a year earlier. We only got them like, I think, like 4 months before the film was finished. So there, you know, there's a hand upon each project, and you just have to trust it.
I appreciate that insight too, because I think in the era of streaming that we live in now, you know, everything seems to move at a million miles an hour. And some stories are meant to be slow crawls to produce.
Yeah, absolutely.
I remember talking with another area filmmaker, Beth Harrington, about her film Winding Stream
that
I think took 10 years as well.
Yeah.
And it's just like, how do you keep this project alive, you know, moving forward? Do you have like a superpower that other people don't have, or you just have this vision that you can't not do?
Well, you know, I think part of it is as you make a film, every new round of interviews is like a growing community, and it's also a kind of accountability, right? Like, you don't want to have to call people up and say, we just decided not to finish it. You know, that's just not a phone call you want to make. But you know, I think each project, you kind of have to tap into a certain sense of calling about it, you know, and this feeling like that without being too heavy or you know, pejorative, you're beholden to this, and you've made a deal with the gods that you're writing it out until it's done.
When I put myself in your shoes of having to call someone like David Geffen and be like, hey, David, I'm so sorry. It's just not going to work out. Like, that conversation in my head would just be like so shrinking and so defeating, because like, it's David Geffen. You don't say that it's not going to work out.
Right. But also just like, you know, the people we make films about, living or dead, you know, they live inside us, and you develop a relationship with them. And there's a sense of honoring, and part of honoring it is just to complete it.
Was there an interview that was just so hard to do, but it was so worthwhile on the other end?
That's a great question. You know, I got to say that the first one that jumps to mind is probably David Geffen, just because, you know, I had to kind of, I don't want to say confront, but, you know, I had asked some hard questions in that interview. But what was so rewarding to me is that after the interview, and you know, you don't hear much about the kind of sensitive side of David Geffen. He's kind of painted with one brush, you know. But after the interview, David came up to me, and he kind of gently touched me on the shoulder and looked me in the eye and just said, please make sure you get my relationship with Judy right, because she meant the world to me. And, you know, I think that's absolutely true. I think David cared deeply about Judy, both as a person and as a musician. And, you know, I hope we did get it right in the film. I think we did.
Collaboration, obviously, in filmmaking is huge. I mean, you can't really make a film on your own. And if you do, it's generally not always that great. What was collaboration like on this project compared to some of the other projects that he's done?
Well, this was really different because it wasn't Cinema Verite, but Alien Boy wasn't Cinema Verite either. But the first benefit, I mean, just it was just great to work with Andy, you know, and it's also just really nice geographically. He was in New York at the time. I'm in Portland. And we could kind of divide and conquer. Like, if there was an interview on the East Coast and I didn't happen to be there at the time, Andy could do it. If there was an interview in LA and Andy couldn't come at the time, I could do it because I'm closer. So it was really nice to kind of divide the labor up. And in terms of like collaboration, I just think it's such a joy, you know? I just love working with people. And, you know, there were so many wonderfully talented people that worked on the Judy Sill film, the late John Campbell, the wonderful cinematographer, Mike Ward, who just made a huge contribution to the film as an editor, Peter Kinney, the producer, who just was resilient and never gave up on the project and always had his eye on the prize, Andrew Saunderson and Amira Degree and Zach Mann, who so generously shot those first interviews in 2013, which just became the kind of, you know, launching point of the film, and their belief in the film, like, made this film possible. The wonderful illustrator, Mia Noltine, who looked through Judy's artwork and then like interpreted some ideas we had and into illustrations that then the wonderfully talented Sam Neiman turned into animation. Gary Meister, who used Judy's stems to create this beautiful score. Let me see here. Nathaniel Aiken, who did an incredible job on motion graphics. George Kostakis, who did an incredible job on the coloring of the film, and which was really challenging because we shot over like 9 years and different kinds of film stocks or formats, or we made it all look seamless. The wonderful Wayne Woods, who is such a gifted post-production sound mixer, and you know, really made Judy sound always great, and you know, wonderful, and also dealt with like literally a 50-year-old audio cassette of her interview and made that sound like, you know, clear and dynamic and beautiful. I hope I'm not forgetting. Danny Ransom, who was an assistant editor, was a huge help. Elena Rosenthal, who transcribed the interviews. I think that's it. if I'm missing anyone, please forgive me. But what's so wonderful about all these people, and especially the kind of core team of Mike Ward, Peter Kenny, Andy Brown, and myself, was just that it was just the best idea, and it didn't matter whose it was, you know. And I just love working like that because you feel like it's a sense of discovery, and you also get the wonderful chance of like trying a thing that you think might be, you know, it was maybe someone's suggestion. You're thinking to yourself, I don't think that's going to work, and it's like, oh my God, it works. You know, and it was also kind of a way of almost feeling like Judy was in the room with us, you know, making these choices. And because a lot of our thought process was, how do we honor Judy? How do we make a film that we think that she would like?
I want to point out, Brian, that you just gave a masterclass in like how to like foster a team spirit by being able to recall the majority of the people that you worked with and the role that they had in the film and the impact that they made. I mean, to anyone listening to this right now, pay attention to what Brian just did in listing all of his collaborators. And the unfortunate thing is you can't see his face because your face lit up when you were talking about every single person. And I am touched beyond belief by what you just did.
Oh, well, thank you, Chris. I just feel so lucky to have worked with all these talented, you know, folks. And there's such an energy of working with people who feel called to do something, you know, like this is really kind of what they, you know, feel like they're put on the earth to do. And it's just a real privilege to work with people like that.
Have you always approached filmmaking as a calling?
You know, I think so. When I was in eighth grade, my wonderful teacher, Mr. Mike Greenfield, who was teaching, I think it was an English class. He also taught Spanish, but it was the day before Christmas break, you know? And so in those days, like a lot of days like that, people would show films because it was kind of like, you know, everyone's kind of squirrely, able to show them a film and relax. And in one of the best teaching moments I've ever had in my life, he asked us all to write down everything we wanted for Christmas. And you can imagine, you know, you're kind of at that age, kind of the height of like just being at the mercy of consumer culture and advertising. And, you know, you have no problem filling out a whole page of like everything you might want, a toy or, you know, clothes or whatever, records. And so we like feverishly write this long list. And then he says, okay, hold on to that list. And then he says, we're going to watch a film first. And he shows A Day in the Life of Bonnie Consuelo, which was a wonderful documentary by a man named Barry Spinelli, I believe. And it's all about this housewife in Florida. And we just go through a day with her. She like goes grocery shopping. She makes dinner. She like, you know, makes doctor's appointments for her kids, just, you know, nothing special except that she has no arms.
Oh, wow.
And it's told without any like self-consciousness. It's just an incredibly straight ahead film, you know? And so Mr. Greenfield shows that film and then he turns the lights on and he says, who wants to share the Christmas list? And you could have heard a pin drop. Like no one wants to say, like, I want a Spirograph, or, you know? And I just remember thinking like, wow, look what that film did, you know? And I knew that like some somehow I really wanted to harness that power and use it in the same way that Mr. Greenfield did.
Like, that is a powerful, powerful moment. I mean, I don't remember what the film technique is where one frame will change the meaning of the frame that follows it. Like, I mean, that right there is like a mic drop. Yeah. From there, did you go to film school or did you go kind of like the path of DIY teach yourself?
Well, I was very lucky in that when I was at Lewis and Clark College, my mentor there, Professor Stuart Kaplan, I'd quickly exhausted all the video classes one could take. And by the way, just to kind of put this in context, I was the first member of my family to go to college. I put myself through school by working summers in a salmon cannery in Cordova, Alaska. So I only bring this up because, like, you know, money was tight. And one day at Lewis and Clark, I'm walking and I open my mailbox and there's a little envelope from Stuart with a gift certificate to a class at the Northwest Film Center. And that just changed my life. I got to take classes there with John Stewart, a wonderful filmmaker, and just became, Gus Van Sant was making films there. There were just so many wonderful, talented people who were completely accessible. You know, I could see them daily working on their thing, and it just made it all very kind of, oh, you can do this. You can be an independent filmmaker. You can make the films you want to make. It just profoundly impacted my life. And then I was very lucky to get a job on a film called Shadow Play that Susan Shadburn was making in Portland. And then that turned into being part of the editing team. And I got to meet wonderful people like George Hood and Paul Diener and Kelly Baker, wonderful Kelly Baker.
I love Kelly Baker, by the way. I'm a huge fan of his.
Yeah, I love Kelly.
I have a second podcast called Beyond Your Imagination, and I'm doing a whole season with Kelly talking about films that we love.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Anyway, so it just really like pointed out to me that there are people that are like Jan Barrows. So there are people that are making Jim Blashfield, there's so many, people making films, and somehow, some way, maybe I could do it too. And then that led to me applying to Columbia Film School and luckily getting in and meeting people like Andy Brown and Peter Kenny, who we worked all together on the Judy Sill film, you know, and just kind of one thing led to the other. But like, I just really want to stress that, you know, my career, such as it is, would never have existed without the Northwest Film Center and the Regional Arts and Culture Council. You know, the Film Center gave me a community, allowed me to teach people, and that was so rewarding. Allowed me to be part of the Filmmaker in the Schools / Filmmaker in the Community program, which directly led to films of mine like Finding Normal and many others. And the Regional Arts and Culture Council, without their grants, you know, I couldn't have made the earlier films I made. And I just want to use this as a little, you know, plug to, you know, really urge people to support local arts organization, because, you know, without them, I think our city is in peril.
And I think too, you raise a really good point of just how things have shifted and changed over the years, that we have put the burden of filmmaking back onto the artist as opposed to helping from a community standpoint to lift them up so that they can do that.
That's so true. And it's true at all levels. You know, like when we started making this film back in 2013, it was a completely different kind of economic model. And frankly, one that at least had a slightly, what's the word? You had a chance, I would say. And now, we finished the film all these years later. And like literally the number of outlets that might buy a film like ours has shrunk, you know, probably, you know, by at least half, if not even more than that. And it's created this environment where the risk, the burden, everything is on the filmmaker. And it's just becoming really hard to make any kind of economic sense. And, you know, I think the danger when that happens is that more and more you get films that are kind of much more of a commodity rather than a personal statement.
So I guess the million-dollar question is, what do we do with that?
We take strength from Judy Sills' slogan, which she always said to her dear friends, which was onwards and upwards, fuck the odds. It's good, isn't it?
That's excellent. Well, Brian, this has been such a fun time talking with you. Is there you've shared so many amazing nuggets of wisdom here. Is there anything you would like to leave the audience with other than Judy Sill's great quote there?
Yeah. Well, you know, I guess I'd be remiss if I didn't take the opportunity to say, please check out Lost Angel, The Genius of Judy Sill. It becomes available on Amazon and Apple on April 12th, and it's in select cities. And please vote with your eyes and your dollars and try to support independent filmmaking.
Well, final question for you. Is there a book, podcast, or film that's blowing your mind right now?
You know, the first thing that leaps to mind is an incredible documentary that was made in 1956. And it's called On the Bowery by Lionel Rogozin. And it's an incredible hybrid of narrative and documentary and what Lionel and his team did. And keep in mind, this is in 1956. So, you know, the camera was probably about as big as a kitchen table. But what they did is they went down to the Bowery, which at that point in New York City was basically the alcoholic population, Skid Row alcoholic population. And they worked with people in that community to write and cast and act and create a story, a film. And it's incredible because it has that power of real people in their own words. And even though the people are playing a character, there's just an undeniable authenticity to it all. And it's just kind of one of the most amazing cinematic achievements I think I've ever seen. And I always, you know, urge people to see it. So it's On the Bowery by Lionel Rogozin.
Well, Brian, thank you so much for being a guest on Getting Work to Work today. I am excited to release this on April 12th. So, you know, as people are listening to this, I'll have the links to Amazon and Apple in the show notes page. So please continue supporting independent film because, you know, there's only so many superhero films that one can enjoy in this lifetime. We need real stories.
Oh, that's well said. And can I just also just a quick shout out to Cinema 21. It was such a great independent theater and, you know, such an important part of our community. And where would we be without it?
Lost Angel, The Genius of Judy Sill is available today on Apple TV and Amazon. Additionally, it does have a limited theatrical release, so check to see if it's playing in your area. That is definitely a great way to show your support of not only this film, but of the independent film community. You can find links to the documentary on the show notes page at gwtw.co/772. I hope you will support this amazing project. A lot of people worked a long time on it, and it's really special. Until next time, may creativity and curiosity fuel your life.